And with Linda Moulton Howe, we're going to come back with another incredible story. How does she find them? Wow. Stand by for what you're going to hear next. Welcome back, Linda Moulton Howe with us. Final hour. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with Linda, as we call it, conversations with Linda. Linda, this next one is just as amazing as all the others.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, it goes back to February this year on Coast. I interviewed Paul Blake Smith from Springfield, Missouri, and he had his new book out, Mo 41, meaning Missouri 41, The Bombshell Before Roswell. Well, Paul researched a UFO crash that had three identical clone gray bodies retrieved on April 12, 1941, that's 6 years before any of the Roswell, near Cape Girardeau.
That's right.
And that was 8 months before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii at the end of that year on December 7th, 1941. Paul is now working on a follow-up book to be released this fall that has surprising revelations about a glowing UFO seen near an airliner crash. And in my earthfiles.com news website tonight, my report that goes with this Coast broadcast includes headlines during the Truman administration when civilian and military plane crashes kept happening at an alarming rate. Planes were reported not being able to gain altitude at takeoff. Some flew straight into mountains in clear skies or suddenly turned over and seemed to fall straight down to the ground. For example, the New York Times reported on May 31, 1947, quote, 53 killed as airliner crashes and burns in Maryland woods. Eyewitnesses at Port Deposit, Maryland say DC-4 turned over in the air, plummeted into a forest, and flame shot up.
Jeez.
Another, round the World Series of plane wrecks kills 180, Associated Press, June 1, 1947. In New Mexico on June 16, 1947, a light plane flying near Mascaro, 220 miles northeast of White Sands Proving Ground, spun out of control into the ground. 2 days later, on June 18, 1947, Associated Press, airplane crash board convenes. President Truman's special board of inquiry held a secret session today seeking means to prevent air crashes, which have taken 146 lives on commercial airlines in only 5 weeks between June 18th and March 29th, 1947, close quote. A direct association between a UFO and a terrible plane crash occurred on January 7th, 1948, when Captain Thomas Mantell was flying a P-51 a little after 3 p.m. toward a very white disc-shaped aerial object with a red border at the bottom that did not move in the afternoon sky for 90 minutes. Mantell radioed back to the Kentucky Godman Army Airfield in Fort Knox, quote, "It appears to be a metallic object, or possibly like the reflection of sun from a metallic object, and it is of tremendous size, around 300 feet in diameter," close quote. Mantell and his plane were found crashed, and some witnesses said Mantell's body and all the metal surfaces of his P-51 were riddled with small holes as if exposed to microwave or other penetrating radiation. Paul Blake Smith speculates that President Roosevelt, who was crippled by polio, and Harry Truman, who would soon be FDR's vice president and then president, knew that peculiar light phenomena were linked to many strange plane crashes in the 1940s. Here now is Paul Blake Smith from Springfield, Missouri.
Harry Truman never discussed what he mentioned to Franklin Roosevelt when they first met to become a team in the summer of 44. They met at the White House, posed for very famous pictures in which Truman recalled later they were having tea outside the White House, and President Roosevelt's hands were so shaky he had more cream in his saucer than he had in his cup. But they cleared away the press and had a private discussion. And Mr. Truman said later, "I can't tell you what we discussed, but one thing President Roosevelt did mention do not take to the air during the fall campaign. Do not fly anywhere. Stay on the ground. Go by train or by car. And that's precisely what the Roosevelt administration did during that campaign. FDR did not take to an airplane. He almost always stuck to the ground. There are mentions in the FBI reports of the lights in the sky. What are these mysterious lights, unexplained lights? And they go through a series of steps of how they could not be air beacons that were on the ground to guide a plane, or they could not have been helicopter, nor a blimp, or a balloon. So they remain officially mysterious within the FBI documents. And just as an example, the author of a book on Carol Lombard's crash called Fireball by Robert Mattson, even he was stonewalled by the FBI to this day. Can't get the documents.
Paul Blake Smith's mention of Carol Lombard refers to one of the most mysterious airliner crashes in U.S. history, and it was linked to a strange stationary yellow light. Carol Lombard, the highest paid actress in Hollywood at the beginning of the 1940s, was a friend of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In January 1942, right after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, FDR asked the actress if she would go on a war bond selling tour in her home state of Indiana. At age 33, Lombard was in her second marriage to another well-known Hollywood actor, Clark Gable. The couple had been guests of President Roosevelt in the White House Oval Office on December 29, 1940, when President Roosevelt delivered one of his most famous fireside chats, the same day that England was heavily bombed by Germany. President Roosevelt told Americans, in the interest of U.S. national security, that we, America, must be the great arsenal of democracy. So on January 11, 1942, only 5 weeks after the Japanese attack, Carol Lombard left Los Angeles on the war bond tour. Lombard had long felt a premonition that she would die young. She had talked about her fear with Clark Gable, who was a Freemason like FDR, Harry Truman, and other government leaders at the time. Also, her mother in early January 1942, before the war bond tour, warned Carol that if she got on a plane, it would crash and Carol would die. Paul Blake Smith reports that even someone in the U.S. Treasury Department told her, quote, please do not travel anywhere by air, close quote. The government source said flying was too dangerous, but would not tell her why. So the actress traveled for 3 days by train from Los Angeles to Indianapolis, arriving on January 13, 1942. In spite of her own ominous gut feeling about flying and other warnings from the U.S. Treasury and her own mother, it was Clark Gable's publicist, Otto Winkler from MGM, assigned to travel with Carol Lombard, who told his wife before they left Los Angeles that he had a terrible nightmare that, quote, if I go on this bond tour and we take to the air, I won't be coming home, close quote. But Carol Lombard was worried that her husband, Clark Gable, was having an affair with another actress, Lana Turner. So on the evening of January 15, 1942, at the end of a very successful war bond tour, Carol decided at the last minute that she did not want to go back to Los Angeles on a slow train. She wanted to fly back quickly. Carol Lombard called for a coin toss to decide if they would fly or not, and she won. Because of her world-famous status, she was able to get her mom, Otto Winkler, and herself confirmed on TWA Flight 3 en route from New York through Indianapolis, with stops in St. Louis, Albuquerque, and Las Vegas. They took off around 3 a.m. on January 16, 1942, even as Carol's mother was still arguing that flying on the 16th of January was bad luck. In Albuquerque, TWA officials tried to bump the Lombard party off to make room for 15 military pilots headed for the war, but Carol Lombard refused to get off. The airmen were crowded on anyway with heavy war gear, so the TWA pilot knew he would have to refuel in Las Vegas. Here now to pick up the story is Paul Blake Smith.
And finally, Las Vegas, where the plane was refueled and guarded by soldiers and was said to be in great mechanical shape, no problems, and it took off and it immediately went off course in the direction of a strange UFO which was hovering over Mount Potosi in the Spring Mountain Range outside of Las Vegas. This was about 30 or 33 miles outside of town when they left the airport, and in just a few minutes, the plane began having terrible power outages, some sort of electromagnetic interference. Rancher Willard George personally testified before the Civil Air Board, taking his deposition, described the light in the sky. He said it was very clear that there was no lights on in the plane that went by, that its power was intermittent, seemingly on and then off. The engines were roaring in the sky due south of me. So as I looked up and saw what appeared to be a large airplane placed at about 7,500-foot level, it seemed to be revolving, not flying right, but in a flat spin. It appeared like a disc revolving in the air, gradually losing altitude. The plane appeared to revolve maybe twice. Then all at once, it went off to the south for 10 seconds, then turned abruptly to the northwest at a 90-degree angle and went into dives, the movements of a porpoise leaping in and out of the water. It would dive and it would climb, and I would judge at least 200 feet each time that it would climb, struggling to gain altitude. After four or five of these dives, said Mr. George, the plane flattened out very close to the mountain and revolved in a flat spin again and then again, losing altitude before it took off in a direction southwest, gradually climbing and then disappearing into the location of Mount Potosi where it crashed. He said, at no time did I see any fire from the motors of the plane, and the cabin appeared to have no lights in it. The only time I saw the plane was silhouetted against the starry sky. He said, at no time were there any landing lights or any other lights lit on this plane. So it's very unusual. Obviously, it had a power outage. The plane disappeared behind a ridge of mountains from his sight and crashed shortly thereafter. He believed it was due to the lack of altitude when it was coming out of these climbs and dives, trying to stabilize, trying to gain enough airspace to get over the approaching mountain range, which it hit level on the mountain.
The description of the rotating airplane has come up in some cases where it appears that UFOs can take over an airplane suspending its flying in the air. So this does fall into the category of a light with electromagnetic interference in military or civilian airplanes.
It does sound like a classic example of that, and once again, this was pretty frightening information for 1942. It even is to this day, and you can see why the FBI, the Roosevelt administration, the Civil Air Board would not want this information released, but it seems awfully strange that the plane checked out mechanically everywhere along the line. It came out in March of 41. It was a pretty new plane. And that it only had trouble after it reached the vicinity of this strange yellow UFO hanging over a mountain outside of Las Vegas.
What makes this significant to me is what I learned from New Mexico State Rep. Andy Kistner in the 90s, that the Truman administration was holding confidential meetings in 1947 to 48. About crashes of military and civilian airplanes linked directly to hostility between the alien presence and our planes in the sky, and that UFOs were demonstrating that they could take planes in the sky down at will. Going back to the January 16, 1942, Carol Lombard crash, is there a link?
Is there a link, and was it done on purpose? That's a great mystery. It's frightening to consider. The Treasury Department repeatedly told her, please do not go by air. They called her the night before and said, do not travel anywhere by air. It's too dangerous for some reason. They would not tell her why, but she had her own premonitions of death through air travel. It's very, very mysterious, and to this day, it's tough to get information. An author named Robert Mattson attempted to get the full FBI report a few years ago and was denied. So he filed a Freedom of Information request, and the FBI hemmed and hawed and said, well, we do have some material here we can send you. And they supposedly mailed it, and then they later claimed, well, sorry, it was lost en route.
Gee, another great story.
In the next half hour, George, we're going to get into what is available in some FBI documents that have come through FOIA, but most of the last 74 years, they're still sealed, George. What are in those documents? But what I thought I would do is remind people of something so similar. This is not the only case, but it's the 1979 Iranian Air Force incident that is so famous and involved, where an F-4 Phantom on the morning of September, early September 19th, 1976, there was one in 76 and one in 79, but mm-hmm. this was where they scrambled to investigate very specifically an unidentified flying object that had been seen from ground citizens, civilian air traffic control, and there was at least one high-ranking military officer. And so these guys are in this F-4 Phantom, and they're approaching this mysterious UFO, this big, bright object in the sky, and all of a sudden, they lose control of everything. And in this particular case, their instruments start rotating and moving in very bizarre fashions, and they end up at one point the helicopter is absolutely as if something grabbed it in the air and stopped it, and they are continually fighting, trying to get back control on their fighter jet, and they are stunned to find that all of their systems at one point are inoperable when they attempted to launch a heat-seeking missile to try to attack the UFO. Nothing would work. Nothing would move. And this is one of those of many examples where our aviation, whether from the United States or another country, in the presence of an object day or night that is unmoving in the sky, seems to take over 100% the electromagnetic functioning of aircraft in the sky. And this story about what happened to the Carol Lombard crash involves the decade of the 1940s, when it was very clear that there was something like a secret war going on between us humans, military, that war, and things in the sky that could take airplanes out of the sky.
And I just don't get why we would try to attack this kind of high technology, Linda.
Well, I guess you think back to the minds of FDR and Truman and George Marshall, the Secretary of War, and Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State. They were all Masons, 33rd degree. They may have had information about other civilizations on this planet through their Freemasonry already, and that this was the time of Hitler threatening to take over the world with tall bonds, and it may have been that at that period of time, with knowledge that we don't have yet, that they decided that they were not only going to war with Hitler, that they were going to war with whatever this technology was.
We're going to come back in a moment with Linda Bolton Howe for another incredible story. And then the last hour of the show, as I've mentioned, it will be conversations with Linda, your phone calls about the stories you've heard tonight, about other stories she has reported on her website, Earth Files. And you can always reach her by sending her an email at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I'm George Norrie, and we will be right back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM, so don't touch your dial. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Bolton Howe with us, and here's her final segment before we go into conversations with Linda. Another equally important story, Linda.
Well, this is continuing. The plane now has crashed on what was January 16th, 1942, with Carol Lombard, her mom, the MGM representative from her husband, Clark Gable, the 15 very well-trained pilots, the crew, and the Los Angeles Times put up huge headline that you can see at earthfiles.com Los Angeles Times, all 22 on Lombard plane killed and burned after hitting cliff. Okay. Now, a week after that inexplicable catastrophic crash of TWA Flight 3 flying with engines powered up straight into Mount Potosi, the chief investigator for the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Safety in Air at the Los Angeles office received a detailed eyewitness account by a rancher who was very close to the scene of this horrible crash into that mountain about 25 miles southwest of Las Vegas. His name is Willard H. George. And this information in this half hour is coming from the few documents that have been released from the FBI and some of the other offices. And starting with the early evening of January 16th, 1942, near the 7:07 p.m. Pacific time that TWA Flight 3 took off from the Las Vegas airport, Mr. George and some friends were 6 to 8 miles west of Las Vegas driving up a mesa. They had been to dinner and they were going up into the night air. He wrote in his letter to the Senate chief investigator that he saw, quote, a reddish-yellow glowing light which seemed suspended in the air. We noticed no flickering on it. It seemed just a glowing light, which might be a light that was covered with a parchment, very unusual light. I want to say that the atmospheric conditions were ideal. The air was still, no wind, very clear, and the stars shone very bright in the sky, close quote. This is the same rancher that Paul Blake Smith quoted earlier as seeing the airliner, quote, revolving from left to right in a flat spin and appeared like a disc revolving in the air and gradually losing altitude and spinning around twice. And then all at once, it went off to the south probably for 10 seconds, then turned abruptly to the northwest at a 90-degree angle and went into dives like movements of a porpoise, leaping in and out of the water at least 200 feet up and 200 feet down, over and over. After making about 4 or 5 of these dives, the plane flattened out again very close to the mountains and revolved in another flat spin once or twice more, losing altitude, and then disappeared in the direction of Portici Mountain. At no time were the landing lights or any other lights lit on the plane. The entire time this plane was going through these movements, the motors were both operating and they were revving at a very high speed. If the pilot had had the plane under control, it would have been very simple for him to turn back to Las Vegas, because when I first heard the roaring sound and saw the first flat spin, he was a full 2 miles east of the Portici Mountain, close quote. Well, 6 weeks after that, the rancher's eyewitness report was in the hands of the FBI, and on March 6, 1942, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, wrote to his special agent in charge in Salt Lake City, Utah, with the subject heading under RE, mentioning sabotage, all caps. Quote, in connection with the investigation being conducted by your office about TWA Flight 3 crash, the information relating to the peculiar lights appearing in the vicinity where the subject airplane crashed might be of interest to the Bureau, close quote. Most of the rest of the FBI files on the strange light and TWA crash are still sealed after 74 years. But one 19-page summary with some redactions was released under FOIA to author Robert Mattson. It is FBI case file 9876, dated March 27, 1942, by the Salt Lake FBI office that confirmed the airliner took off from the Las Vegas airport at 7:07 p.m. Pacific, and only 15 minutes later, at 7:22 p.m., it had flown with engines revved up straight into Mount Pelosi, about 500 feet below the mountain's 8,517 feet crest. The impact was so hard that one side of the airliner split open and bodies, mail, luggage, and plane parts were scattered over a wide rocky area. Only the Clark County Sheriff's Office was allowed to take photographs at the site. It was established that the plane was following an incorrect flight plan that led directly into the mountain near a restricted military site, but the reason why the experienced pilot and co-pilot did not clear the mountaintop on a clear night is not understood, and electromagnetic interference by the nearby UFO might be responsible. Here again is Paul Blake Smith from Springfield, Missouri.
The plane for Carol Lombard appears to have received quite a good deal of power outage, electrical outage. It lost its ability to control and maneuver in the flight. Dr. Otto Krauss, who mentioned the aerial accident in Missouri producing alien technology that was utilized in American technology, possibly even the atomic bomb. And in the 1960s, he was discussing this matter with a friend who reported later that Dr. Krauss mentioned that electromagnetic frequencies between alien UFOs and man-made aircraft or entire neighborhoods and towns would cause power outages. The frequencies were not jibing with each other, they were clashing with each other, and that the extraterrestrial technology would overpower what man had produced in a car, a plane, an entire neighborhood, or even an entire small town. Now, that brings to mind the research of Jacques Vallée, who did many stories on this in the 1960s and early 70s on how airliners and fighter pilots and others were producing stories that causes of their power outages in flight. The power would be going out once they sighted a UFO in the close proximity. The airliner, the airplane, would lose its power, or another vehicle on the ground, perhaps. And Steven Spielberg acquired this information and worked it into his screenplay and into his movie, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where we saw Richard Dreyfuss lose power to his pickup truck and entire neighborhood suddenly lose power and then regain it and then perhaps lose it again. And that is precisely what it was described by an eyewitness on the ground of the Carol Lombard flight. And that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover took this very seriously. We can speculate that he was investigating the Cape Girardeau UFO crash through his field agents at the time and knew that an alien craft had crashed in Cape Girardeau 9 months previously. And even to this day, you can't get the full unexpurgated FBI file, even though Carol Lombard's plane crash was supposed to be a simple pilot error.
In the early 1980s, I was at Leonard Stringfield's house, and he was showing me letters and documents, and he was talking to me about animal mutilations and human abductions. He said that he knew firsthand, having been for a period of time in the United States Air Force in the early 50s. He said, "We had a standing order to shoot down any unidentified flying object in the UFO category. There was retaliation by the UFOs. Serious payback is the phrase he used. And we dropped the order to fire on UFOs." Maybe that is the change that there was between FDR and Truman. Maybe they were trying to bring down unidentified flying objects that they knew were an alien presence, and they were actively using microwave and whatever they had to try to bring them down. Then they suffered all of these consequences in military and civilian planes, small and large. They rescinded that order, and then maybe by the 50s, all of these plane crashes linked to the UFO phenomena stopped because we rescinded the shoot down order.
Well, Harry Truman would have probably been the source for the shoot-down order. He knew a great deal about UFOs, starting with the Cape Girardeau, Missouri crash. It was his constituency that was involved, so he knew plenty by the time he took office. And by 1947, these incidences occur, and it's interesting to speculate. Franklin Roosevelt gave the same shoot-down order that was rebelled against or fought against by any extraterrestrial presence in the January 42 Lombard plane crash. When we go to the 1947 white-hot report written about the Roswell, New Mexico incident, it mentions not only the Missouri recovery of 1941, but intrusions in our airspace that occurred in early 1942.
Yes, Paul, and I have that paragraph from President Truman's MJ-12 Special Study Group. It's the Project White Hot Intelligence Estimate. The date was September 24th, 1947, not long after the early July crashes in the Roswell region. And the contributing members listed on this report are Professor Albert Einstein, Dr. James H. Doolittle, Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, and Dr. Theodore von Karman. Part 5, National Security Structure, says, quote, in the early months of 1942, up until the present, intrusions of unidentified aircraft have occasionally been documented, but there has been no serious investigations by the intelligence arm of the government. Even the recovery case of 1941 did not create a unified intelligence effort to exploit possible technological gains, with the exception of the Manhattan Project. We now have an opportunity to extend our technology beyond the threshold that we have achieved by directly working with the aliens on technology transfer. Aside from technological gains, we face an even greater challenge, that of learning the intent of such a presence. There are questions that remain unanswered, such as, what forces face us? What kind of defense do we have? Where do they come from? And what kind of weapons do they possess? Where can we stage our forces in advance? And how many craft can we expect?
And I'm thinking those were two references to the Cape Girardeau crash and the Carol Lombard crash. We know that in the aftermath of the Lombard crash, the Roosevelt administration authorized the creation of a warship in the Los Angeles area, and two were created in the early 1944 period. Then one was named the SS Carol Lombard, and the other was named the SS Cape Girardeau. They were christened and released into the Pacific Ocean, fought in the Pacific Theater during the war. Was this a coincidence, or was this dedication from President Franklin Roosevelt, who did not pass away until April of 1945?
Today in 2016, are the signs that the policies of denial might be cracking, announcement of all of this connected? JFK, Carol Lombard, all of the crashes, to an alien presence that may be in conflict with another alien presence, as well as what has been happening between aliens and humans. What do you think the upside and downside is of that announcement?
Well, we certainly know that not all human beings are friendly and likable, and it may be the case that all visiting, observing extraterrestrials are the same way. Some may well be pleasant and friendly and openly hoping to share their knowledge and their technology with us. Others are here to cause trouble. That may be the reason why the government has kept the lid on this story for over 75 years and may continue to do so. But if it is released, we may have to face a new reality that we have visitors to our world who are not exactly in favor of helping us. And this might explain a recent quote by that Army Chief of Staff who talked about hybrid armies and visitors from other worlds that we may have to be fighting in the future. It's just bizarre, but you would hope that people will not panic. I hope to live to see it. I don't know if it will happen.
If it doesn't, this is way beyond visitors. This is planet Earth has been manipulated, harvested for at least 270 million years, according to one DIA source. That means that the questions that reverberate throughout all of this, whose planet is this really? Who are humans? What is our relationship to the current alien presence? Who are our allies? Who are the unfriendlies? And what does the future hold? If we continued a lie, living as civilizations on this planet, how could that possibly be constructive toward the evolution in this century? If we tell the truth, let the chips fall where they may, to all religions, all races, everywhere on the planet, isn't that healthier and stronger in the long run?
I believe so. In the 1970s, the CIA was supposedly considering something called a limited hangout, in which they would grudgingly admit a few involvements in the mafia, CIA assassination of President Kennedy. A limited hangout. We won't get all the information. We'll just get a few dribs and drabs and hope that the American public will be satisfied with that. That tends to be the way our government works.
And it must be really serious if they still, after World War II to 2016, they still haven't opened up the truth. And the truth is, we're not alone on this planet.
I believe that is the case, and we may see more of this in the future. I certainly am optimistic, but guardedly so.
And it is, George, like being able to dig into history that a lot of us were not aware of what had happened around this Carol Lombard airline crash, I'm sure, that we didn't know that J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI were investigating the lights and that there are files that are still sealed. And I'm holding in my hand one that is Federal Bureau of Investigation date made of this 19-page report. It's the biggest one. March 27th, 42, it was made in Salt Lake City. It does a synopsis of what happened in the crash. This is stamped with the Federal Bureau of Investigation's dates, times. And on page 5, just to give you a feeling of what these people in the FBI and the ones that were up there on the mountain and our government knew. Listen to this.
30 seconds, Linda.
It appeared to the plane hit the mountain in a normal flying position, hitting with the left wing first on the sheer granite wall, and it apparently spun the plane so that one entire side flew open, cracked open, split open, and everything in that plane went out on that steep, rocky mountain. That is control of the electromagnetic system of that TWA flight.
Strange story, sad story as well. Up next, Conversations with Linda.